I'm going to start in the middle there. Last time, we covered about half of Book 2. And I'm going to back up just a little bit to Canto 6 of Book 2. And go through several cantos, reading selections and commenting a little bit. What we are doing is we are searching for patterns, themes, structures, and intentions. To understand the intention of Sri Aurobindo is, I think, the most important thing that we have to do. In this book, what distinguishes it from Book 1 is that the theme is not anymore the two who are one. The theme is now the dualities of existence, which are the result of the manifestation or the descent of the two who are one. It heard me, right? Comprehend what Sri Aurobindo's intention is in this book is quite a challenge for the human mind. I tried to make the point especially clearly in the three or four commentaries on Savitri in the last session, the last series. That this this kind of mantric poetry is meant to convey to us a force of consciousness. It's quite different from what we just heard from the Rig Veda. And the best way to allow that force of consciousness, which is his real intention, to reach us, is by reading a canto fully, rhythmically, and continuously. To try to grasp something from reading fragments and commenting upon them is not the way really to discover Sri Aurobindo's intention. So, it's a little bit paradoxical for me to tell you that in this book, Sri Aurobindo is attempting to convey the force of consciousness of the dualities of existence in this book. The force of consciousness of the dualities of existence. Is at the core of manifestation. This is not an idea. It's not a poetic image. The force of consciousness that manifests as the dualities of existence is a truth, capital T, that Sri Aurobindo refers to in that passage from the Life Divine that we read on Monday night. A truth that has to be seen and known in its totality as itself, what it actually is in itself. So, that's what Sri Aurobindo wants to convey to us, because he is speaking from that grasp of the force of consciousness as the dualities of existence, and attempting to transmit fully the power and depth of the most difficult aspects of manifestation, mortality and immortality. Normally, we don't know what those two words mean until we die. To really know what mortality is, or what immortality is, to grasp its truth, means to die, normally. No, but you do have an opportunity to grasp it.
Right, and it must
In that moment of its reality. And if you are a yogi, you can bring about death and immortality in the body, consciously, but not otherwise, normally. And so for Sri Aurobindo to write mantric poetry whose intention is to convey the inner reality of the thing itself to the hearing, seeing mind, to ensoul the mind with the inner reality of the thing itself. That's what this book of cantos is attempting to do with such realities as suffering and joy. Pain and pleasure in their essential duality. Not just pains and pleasures, but pain and pleasure in its essential nature of duality. So we ended last time with a line that said that time and space are the result of the light entering into the absolute, the darkness. The duality of absolute luminous force and absolute nothing in their confrontation, in their interaction, is what produces manifestation. Well, that's a kind of vertical concept. Then, what results from that descent of the two who are one is the unfolding in time and space of duality itself on a horizontal plane. And so everything that happens in time and space is the stretching and the contracting of dual realities, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, life, death, life, death, suffering, joy. Two that he mentions, trust and deception, truth and falsehood. And in our experience, in our living experience, if we're really honest with ourselves, we are in the middle of good and evil, truth and falsehood, trust and deception, life and death, all the time. And we fool ourselves by thinking that this moment, in this moment of truth, we are not being deceived. In this moment of pleasure, pain is away from us. But it's a falsehood. It's the nature of our consciousness. It is the nature of mind itself. So what we will hear in the selections from these cantos is how mind, the reality of mind, is nothing more or less than this time-space unfolding of dualities. That's what mind is. And we are the mental being. We are that being in which mind is totally present. No longer involved in just automatic functioning and just vital energy transformations, but fully emerged so that all of the automatic functions, all of the vital movements are conscious for the most part, mentalized, deliberate to the extent that they can be deliberate. Realizing that the nature of things, which is this nature of duality, is exactly what pushes mind to go beyond itself. At the point where mind is sufficiently conscious of the dual nature of its existence, it begins to seek liberation. And that seeking of liberation is what brings into manifestation forces that begin to alter the duality, begin to resolve the dualities. So, reading. No, please don't stop it. I'll be totally wet from top to bottom when I leave here if we stop it. No, it drifted.
Put off the main switch and then it's... that's it, it's ready. Maybe I try it, of course.
I think it's okay.
Before it's working already, then I put it off the switch.
Anyway, it's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt anything. It's going to save my life. So the secret of Savitri is that Sri Aurobindo, with his yogic grasp of the nature of things and his gift for mantric speech, is actually able to convey the truths or the truth of the dualities in a way that puts us in touch with existence more closely than we normally are. And by coming more closely into touch with existence, we become more conscious, and the force of yoga becomes more accessible to us. And this becomes a yogic guide. Otherwise, there's no point in it, actually. So, we're going to just hear a few passages that will perhaps convey to us little by little, through their rhythms and images, something of the nature of the duality of existence. And you will also notice that there are passages that are almost identical. So the point here is that Sri Aurobindo puts his consciousness in touch with the reality and then conveys it through a series of rhythmic images. And then later on, he puts himself in touch with that reality and conveys it again in another series of very similar rhythms and images, because he just wants to convey this truth of existence. And this is the amount of energy that he put into it. So the information doesn't change throughout this book of cantos, but the power of the truth that's being conveyed builds up until eventually we might get it. And when we get it, something happens which is real. It's total. It's not mental, and it's not the appreciation of poetry and so on. It's a yogic movement that happens because mantric language has the power to guide consciousness along its tracks in its channel of perception. It's not essentially conveying information at all. It is taking consciousness along its path. And this part of the path is about plunging into dualities and feeling them and seeing them and allowing them to work on the evolution of consciousness. And you know, there's at the beginning of one of these cantos, he says, something about yoga. A mind absolved from life, made calm to know. A heart divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance. A mind absolved from life. He turned to find that wide world failure's cause. So this is the movement of yoga. And we will hear it much more explicitly in Book 3. But in this book, he prepares that ground. Because the dualities can only be resolved and overcome when that has been done. When the cause of the world's failure is found. And that can only be done when the mind is absolved from life. Then could he see the hidden heart of night. A spiritless, blank infinity was there. So, we will build allow Sri Aurobindo to build a pathway towards that and also to reveal its necessity. In a half-lit air of hazardous mystery. Oh, you need to have the words. I would just like to comment on this also. The mind is very keen on having an eye contact with something. And that's a mental habit. So, to truly get the meaning of Savitri, it's very essential not to use the eyes and the mind. Unfortunately, we have this attachment to the written word. But Sri Aurobindo has made it very clear that the I, as he says, does not get it. So, as long as one is using the I, one is not going to get it. It's as simple as that. So it was in the right place, by the way. Right here. But I'm telling you that reading it while hearing it is a big mistake. So you have an opportunity right now to break your habit, or you can indulge your habit. In a half-lit air of hazardous mystery, the eye that looks at the dark half of truth made out an image mid a vivid blur, and peering through a mist of subtle tints, he saw a half-blind, chained divinity. Bewildered by the world in which he moved, yet conscious of some light prompting his soul, attracted to strange, far-off shimmerings, led by the fluting of a distant player, he sought his way amid life's laughter and call, and the index chaos of her myriad steps towards some total deep infinitude. Around crowded the forest of her signs. At hazard he read, by arrow leaps of thought that hit the mark by guess or luminous chance, her changing colored road lights of idea. And her signals of uncertain, swift event, the hieroglyphs of her symbol pageantries, and her landmarks in the tangled paths of time. In her mazes of approach and of retreat, to every side she draws him and repels. But drawn too near, escapes from his embrace. Always she leads him, but no way is sure. Allured by the many-toned marvel of her chant, attracted by the witchcraft of her moods, and moved by her casual touch to joy and grief, he loses himself in her, but wins her not. Brief are her snatches of felicity that touch the surface, then escape or die. A lost remembrance echoes in her depths. A deathless longing is hers. A veiled self's call. A prisoner in the mortal's limiting world. A spirit wounded by life sobs in her breast. A cherished suffering is her deepest cry. A wanderer on forlorn, despairing routes. Along the roads of sound, a frustrate voice, forsaken, cries to a forgotten bliss. Astray in the echo caverns of desire. It guards the phantoms of a soul's dead hopes and keeps alive the voice of perished things or lingers upon sweet and errant notes hunting for pleasure in the heart of pain. A fateful hand has touched the cosmic chords, and the intrusion of a troubled strain covers the inner music's hidden key that guides unheard the surface cadences. Yet is it joy to live and to create, and joy to love and labor though all fails, and joy to seek though all we find deceive. And all on which we lean betrays our trust. Yet something in its depths was worth the pain. A passionate memory haunts with ecstasy's fire. Even grief has joy hidden beneath its roots, for nothing is truly vain the one has made. In our defeated hearts, God's strength survives. And victory's star still lights our desperate road. Our death is made a passage to new worlds. This, to life's music, gives its anthem swell. To all she lends the glory of her voice, heaven's raptures whisper to her heart and pass. Earth's transient yearnings cry from her lips and fade. Alone the God-given hymn escapes her art that came with her from her spiritual home, but stopped halfway and failed. A silent word awake in some deep pause of waiting worlds. A murmur suspended in eternity's hush, but no breath comes from the supernal peace A sumptuous interlude occupies the ear, and the heart listens, and the soul consents. An evanescent music it repeats, wasting on transience time's eternity. A tremolo of the voices of the hours, oblivious screams the high intended theme. The self-embodying spirit came to play on the vast clavichord of nature force. Only a mighty murmur here and there of the eternal word, the blissful voice, or beauty's touch transfiguring heart and sense. A wandering splendor and a mystic cry recalls the strength and sweetness heard no more. A mind absolved from life, made calm to know. A heart divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance, he turned to find that wide world failure's cause. Away he looked from nature's visible face, and sent his gaze into the viewless vast, the formidable unknown infinity, asleep behind the endless coil of things that carries the universe in its timeless breaths, and the ripples of its being are our lives. The worlds are built by its unconscious breath, and matter and mind are its figures or its powers, our waking thoughts the output of its dreams. The veil was rent that covers nature's depths. He saw the fount of the world's lasting pain, and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance. The evil guarded at the roots of life raised up its head and looked into his eyes. On a dim bank where dies subjective space, from a stark ridge overlooking all that is, a tenebrous awakened nescience, her wide blank eyes wondering at time and form, stared at the inventions of the living void and the abyss whence our beginnings rose. Behind appeared a gray carved mask of night, watching the birth of all created things. A hidden puissance, conscious of its force, a vague and lurking presence everywhere, a contrary doom that threatens all things made, a death figuring as the dark seed of life, seemed to engender and to slay the world. The Then from the somber mystery of the gulfs and from the hollow bosom of the mask, something crept forth that seemed a shapeless thought, a fatal influence upon creatures stole, whose lethal touch pursued the immortal spirit. On life was laid the haunting finger of death, and overcast with error, grief, and pain, the soul's native will for truth and joy and light. A deformation coiled that claimed to be the being's very turn, nature's true drive, a hostile and perverting mind at work in every corner ensconced of conscious life, corrupted truth with her own formulas. Interceptor of the listening of the soul. Afflicting knowledge with the hue of doubt. It captured the oracles of the occult gods, effaced the signposts of life's pilgrimage, canceled the firm rock edicts graved by time, and on the foundations of the cosmic law erected its bronze pylons of misrule. Even light and love, by that cloaked danger's spell, turned from the brilliant nature of the gods to fallen angels and misleading suns, became themselves a danger and a charm, a perverse sweetness, heaven-born malefice. Its power could deform divinest things. A wind of sorrow breathed upon the world. All thought with falsehood was besieged. All act stamped with defect, or with frustration's sign, all high attempt with failure or vain success. But none could know the reason of his fall. Okay, one more along those lines. The difference between this and myth, the mythic structure, what we were hearing earlier tonight was the mythic structure. In the mythic structure, we just have duality. What I mean. In the mythic structure of the Rig Veda, you were hearing earlier, we're just told that the light enters the darkness and holds it on every side, and all the gods are there. And by their call, they make creation unfold and we get to be conscious. That's the mythic structure. This is not
that. That if we stopped with book one, in which Sri Aurobindo recites the two who are one, are the might and right in things, then we would stop with the mythic structure. But Sri Aurobindo doesn't stop with the mythic structure. He undertakes a yoga of transformation. And on the way in that yoga, he seeks the cause of the world's failure, not as an abstract mythic understanding, but as a force to plunge into the cause itself and bring there light. So there's this line which is not on the page right now, but I'm just going to skip ahead. I'll just end with that one.
What you said is the mystic structure. I learned a lot of teachers to be open, to be alone, and to be whole to this. And I think when I have to use my mind here, it's the same mystic structure, that I just open and receive everything. It's also mystic structure.
If for terrible agencies the spirit allows. And there are subtle and enormous powers that shield themselves with the covering ignorance. Offspring of the gulfs. Somehow the darkness itself, the universe itself, the very fact of the atomic void produces these offspring. Offspring of the gulfs, agents of the shadowy force, haters of light, intolerant of peace, aping to the thought, the shining friend and guide, opposing in the heart the eternal will, they veil the occult uplifting harmonist. His wisdom's oracles are made our bond. The doors of God they have locked with keys of creed, and shut out by the law his tireless grace. Along all nature's lines they have set their posts and intercept the caravans of light. Wherever the gods act, they intervene. A yoke is laid upon the world's dim heart. Masked are its beats from the supernal bliss and the closed peripheries of brilliant mind block the fine entries of celestial fire. All of our knowledge of the grand structure of existence blocks the entries of the celestial fire. Sometimes. Always the dark adventurers seem to win. Nature they fill with evil's institutes. Turn into defeats the victories of truth. That's religion. Proclaim as falsehoods the eternal laws. And load the dice of doom with wizard lies. The world's shrines they have occupied, usurped its thrones, in scorn of the dwindling chances of the gods, they claim creation as their conquered fief and crown themselves the iron lords of time. Adepts of the illusion and the mask, the artificers of nature's fall and pain, have built their altars of triumphant night in the clay temple of terrestrial life. Armored, protected by their lethal masks, as in a studio of creative death, the giant sons of darkness sit and plan the drama of the earth, their tragic stage. All who would raise the fallen world must come under the dangerous arches of their power. For even the radiant children of the gods, to darken their privilege is, and dreadful right. None can reach heaven who has not passed through hell. This too the traveler of the worlds must dare. A warrior in the dateless duel strife, he entered into dumb, despairing night, challenging the darkness with his luminous soul, alarming with his steps the threshold gloom. He came into a fierce and dolorous realm, peopled by souls who never had tasted bliss. Ignorant like men born blind, who know not light, they could equate worst ill with highest good. Virtue was to their eyes a face of sin, and evil and misery were their natural state. I'm just going to follow this theme a little bit further along. Into the abysmal secrecy he came, where darkness peers from her mattress, gray and nude, and stood on the last locked subconscious floor, where being slept, unconscious of its thoughts, and built the world not knowing what it built. There, waiting its hour, the future lay unknown. There of the vanished stars. There, in the slumber of the cosmic will, he saw the secret key of nature's change. A light was with him, an invisible hand was laid upon the error and the pain, till it became a quivering ecstasy. The shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace. He saw in night the eternal's shadowy veil. New death for a seller of the house of life. In destruction felt creation's hasty pace. New loss as the price of a celestial gain, and hell as a shortcut to heaven's gates. Then in illusion's occult factory, and in the inconscience magic printing house, torn were the formats of the primal night, and shattered the stereotypes of ignorance. Alive, breathing a deep spiritual breath, nature expunged her stiff mechanical code and the articles of the bound soul's contract. Falsehood gave back to truth her tortured shape. Annulled were the tables of the law of pain, and in their place grew luminous characters, the skillful penman's unseen finger wrote his swift intuitive calligraphy. Earth's forms were made his divine documents. The wisdom embodied mind could not reveal. In conscience chased from the world's voiceless breast, transfigured were the fixed schemes of reasoning thought. Arousing consciousness in things inert, he imposed upon dark atom and dumb mass the diamond script of the imperishable, inscribed on the dim heart of fallen things, a paean song of the free infinite, and the name, foundation of eternity, and traced on the awake, exultant cells in the ideographs of the ineffable, the lyric of the love that waits through time, and the mystic volume of the Book of Bliss, and the message of the superconscient fire. Then life beat pure in the corporeal frame. The infernal gleam died and could slay no more. Hell split across the huge, abrupt facade. God as if a magic building were undone. Night opened and vanished like a gulf of dream. Into being's gap, scooped out as empty space in which she had filled the place of absent God, there poured a wide, intimate, and blissful dawn. Healed were things that time's torn heart had made, and sorrow could live no more in nature's breast. Division ceased to be, for God was there. The soul lit the conscious body with its ray. Matter and spirit mingled and were one. Around him shone a great felicitous day. So that brings us up to Canto 9. 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 are travels through the luminous plains. But the luminous plains are also fraught with dualities. And they don't have the power to alter definitively the nature of existence. That yogic act, which we just heard, was the necessary movement of the yogic consciousness. It wasn't the transformation of the world itself. It was the liberation of a soul that could bring light into the absolute foundation of the ignorance, so that all of the ascending planes can be traveled. And eventually, he comes to the conclusion, which is Book 3, that this yogic passage itself is not enough. It's only a preparation, it's only a path, and it's necessary, but it's not enough. So next time we'll do Book 3, which is the Yoga of Aswapati, back online from Book 1. And Sri Aurobindo actually spent a number of years writing this Book 2 after the Yoga of Aswapati. So that history is not terribly important, but it was obviously for him important to provide this cyclic exposure, to provide an exposure to the mind of the spiritual aspirant to the limits, both the outer limits and the inner limits of all the planes, where duality is the law. So that we don't think that we have gotten somewhere too soon.